Aloha. Welcome to The Conversation. This is Catherine Cruz. It has been a week since the city took control over the second segment of rail or skyline service from HART, the Honolulu Authority for Rapid Transportation. The service opens to the public a week from Thursday. We get the latest on what you should know about riding the train. We also get the latest on the cuts to federal energy projects here in Hawaii. And there's a new AI video model out, and experts say they're struggling to distinguish between what's real and what's a deep fake. And in today's Mono Minute, we meet a chorus of shorebirds. Plus, we hear about the history of breadfruit. It's a story we thought we knew, but today we learn about the twists and turns it took as it spread across the globe. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. This is a big month for Skyline. The city's rail system opens its second leg from the Aloha Stadium to Middle Street. The 5.2-mile segment will include key employment centers, the airport, and Pearl Harbor. And it will mean reworking the bus schedules in the urban core to accommodate transfers. Deputy Director John Noguchi joined us in studio this morning to give us the overview.
You know, we're absolutely excited to add on another 5 miles and another 4 stations. And it seems a little short, but this is extremely significant in that it'll connect the other 11 miles and 9 stations to major job centers in this 5 mile, 4 station extension.
And we have been waiting for this. Many people have been waiting for the opportunity to get to the airport, without having to drive their car and leave it over there overnight. So we're talking not just visitors, but residents.
Yeah, and I think it actually is more keyed towards our residents. And I love delivering that for the people on our island. You know, I think there's a lot of sentiment sometimes that everything we do is based around our visitor industry. And in this case, you'll go out to the Skyline station at the airport and find that Skyline goes west. It's for the benefit of our own people right now who live everywhere west of the airport. And I think that's just a great thing to introduce to people. And part of that effort is to, you know, just really show people that this is something new and, you know, give it a try.
Well, you know, I actually drove the route this weekend just to get my bearings. And I get the military stop, Makalapa Gate. I get the airport. But I was scratching my head at Lagoon Drive. You know, I mean, Middle Street, yeah, that's the bus terminal, right? So, yeah, explain Lagoon Drive.
So, Ahua Lagoon Drive, I think a lot of people have told us, you know, why there? And I think it's really an invisible job center. So, certainly, we have the airport, which everybody would recognize as a huge job center. But all the businesses, all the industrial businesses we have there, it is a concentration of density that is pretty unique. And that there is a definite constituent and passenger base there that is very excited to receive this new Skyline service. So, you know, you talked about driving the route this weekend. Let's kind of walk this in the east. So we are currently open at Halawa Aloha Stadium Station. The route will go eastwards. Our next stop will be at the Makalapa Joint Base Pearl Harbor Hickam for those very constituents, the people who work in the shipyard, the people who work on base, who work on Hickam. It'll continue into the Lelepawa Daniel K. Inouye International Airport Station for anybody who is embarking upon a ride into the sky via airplane or the people that work there daily. You know, we have TSA, we have USDA, we have all the airline employees, and even our partners at the Hawaii Department of Transportation who work at the airport. It'll continue east to the Ahua Lagoon Drive Station, and right there we have all the ground transportation in the industrial areas. We have a lot of small businesses there, including Hawaii Candy. We have United Laundry. We have so many other things there. We actually have our larger partners, too, for ground logistics, FedEx, UPS, and a lot of the, I like to think of them as the invisible industries that really fuel what we do, all the kitchens that do all the catering for all of our flights that come in and out of our airport. And so there's this huge ridership base at the Ahua Lagoon Drive Station and where we can serve. And we continue eastward to the Kahoʻiki Kalihi Transit Center station, which really is a gateway to Kalihi. At Kalihi Transit Center, you can get on a bus that'll take you Malcolm Mackay. It'll take you everywhere between what I like to call West Kalihi or West Honolulu and everything in between till you get to Chinatown and downtown.
And I know you folks were looking at this additional service, what, Air, Land, and Sea?
Yeah, Air, Land, and Sea. I mean, you know, we have the Joint Base Pearl Harbor. That's our sea component and, you know, our HICM, our air component too. But then we have the airport, Ride the Sky on Skyline, but ride it to the sky, into the air. And then we have all the ground logistics at Ahua Lagoon Drive, you know, all the trucking and all those other kinds of work and stuff that goes on there. And then we connect to our one of our busiest transit hubs with the bus is Kalihi Transit Center.
And so I don't know if you want to talk about what riders need to prepare for as you make these changes and add this new service.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a part of this new opening of Segment 2 of Skyline that we want to hype up a lot more. And that's our rapid bus connections to Skyline. You know, internally, we've been working on these changes for about 3 years now. And we believe that they're ready for the public, and we can't wait to welcome people aboard these rapid buses. In-house, I'll share with you, just in-house, we've been calling them landlines because, you know, they connect to Skyline. And these landlines are an extension of the Skyline service. They connect to and from Skyline and take people to the major destinations in a very straight line fashion with very limited stops and express service with a huge amount of frequency and a huge span of service. So of these landlines that we have that will connect to Skyline, we have the A line, the U line, and the W line. And let me go through those in order. So the A line will connect to Skyline at the Ahua Lagoon Drive station, and that will replicate our current route A City Express. But it will take people on the freeway. It'll exit the freeway and service Chinatown, downtown, Kaka'ako, Ala Moana, Makali, and at UH Manoa. So it is basically a shortened version with increased frequency of our current Route A. The U line is something we are very excited to introduce. The U line will be a very quick express between the Ahua Lagoon Drive station and UH Manoa and Kaimuki. So for our East Honolulu residents too, that's a real boon. This is probably the fastest service we could provide. So supposing somebody comes in from the west side, they get off of Skyline at Ahua, which is, you know, notably one station before the terminus, the temporary terminus at Kalihi, but we want them to get off at Lagoon Drive to board a U-Line. The very next stop will be UH Manoa Campus Center.
Wow.
So that bus is going to go on the freeway all the way to Campus Center. And we believe that that's the way to bring, you know, our UH Manoa students and give them the benefit of a quick Skyline trip, that, you know, Skyline always on time service, and extend them to just going one stop past Lagoon all the way to UH Manoa and then connecting to East Honolulu. It'll take you as far as Kapi'olani Boulevard and Wai'alae Avenue. So right by Market City, where anybody can then transfer to you know, a one or any of the other major services that come through there. So even going to Waikiki, that would help. But we also have the third piece of this, which is the W line. And the W line, I think, is the hidden, I mean, maybe like not the big secret, but it is going to be a powerhouse of ridership. So the W line spans between the Lalepawa Daniel K. Inouye Airport Station inside of the airport, also connects to the Ahua Lagoon Drive station, but then also straight lines down Nimitz Highway all the way to Waikiki, making limited stops for rapid express service. And it will run frequently in both directions. So it is really a new ride between Waikiki and the airport for everyone. And, you know, I think people have questioned why we wanted to provide that rapid link. And, you know, one of the things is now that we have Skyline servicing our airport, we've really crossed into a certain echelon of being a world-class city with rail transit at our airport. But it's really hard to do that. If you look at many other cities, they did not do this on their first try. You know, LA is still trying to connect, and there's so many cities, even like LaGuardia Airport in New York, who don't have rail transit touching them. And so, like we talked about earlier, Skyline goes west from the airport, so we thought it was responsible to put in a rapid bus that goes east from the airport, and it's not just intended to be for our visitors.
Well, I'm excited because I live in Kaimuki, and I can jump on the U-Line.
Can you imagine?
And get out to Kapolei.
Yeah, yeah.
It's been such a long time coming. I don't know, gosh, what you folks are doing to help get the buzz going and get people to start planning, because this will be something that will be open next weekend.
By this time next week, we will be celebrating and commemorating and commissioning this system, so that by next Thursday, we're ready to welcome people aboard at 4 a.m. And, you know, it is a really interesting time that people, you know, on Wednesday, their ride will be something on our bus system and our Skyline system. And on Thursday, everything's going to change. So we're deploying a lot of manpower to just go out and make sure people know where they're going, know what stations to get on and off at, how their ride's going to change. But we do immediately follow that with a free weekend on the 19th and 20th, the immediate next weekend. And that is with a holo card. Anybody can ride free on Skyline and the bus. And that's important. I want people to get out there and go explore. Go see how these stations can work for them, especially the airport station. It's good to, you know, be able to figure out how to get to the terminals. And we have land bridges and all these new connections at the airport. And, you know, our partners with HDOT have been so good to work with in integrating the station right inside the airport. It's not like in other cities where it's like a side afterthought where we pushed it off to where they had space. It is smack dab in the middle of our airport. And that's a tremendous feat.
Yeah, so this is really going to be a game changer, I think, for a lot of people.
Yeah.
We've been hearing from City Deputy Transportation Director John Noguchi. He joined us in studio earlier this morning to talk about the opening of the latest segment of Skyline. The public will get a chance to ride the new leg starting October 16th at 4 a.m. We'll have links to find out all the details that you need to know on our website later today.
There were cheers when Malaysia's soccer team won a qualifying playoff game in June. But now a cheating scandal is calling all that into question. FIFA is accusing players of using fake birth certificates to get on the team. That story next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
On the next Fresh Air, Grammy Award-winning singer and musician Leve sings and plays some songs for us. Her music is a hybrid of pop, jazz, and classical music. She had rigorous classical training in Iceland, where she's from. Her mother, who's Chinese, plays in the Iceland Symphony Orchestra. Leve has a new album. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
The dust has yet to settle on the news that President Donald Trump plans to cut close to $8 billion in green energy projects in mostly Democratic states. HPR Savannah Harriman-Pote has been tracking the impact on Hawaii and joins us now. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so tell us about this list.
Yeah, so I was able to get my hands on a list of awards that the Department of Energy reportedly sent to Congress. This list, when I got it, was pretty bare bones. So last Thursday, after the news was announced, I set about trying to cross-reference what information I had with what information is available in public databases about government funding. And through that process, I identified 6 awards that were earmarked for 5 Hawaii projects. So one of the projects is receiving 2 sources of federal funding.
So what kinds of projects are we talking about?
Well, About half of them are coming through the Hawaii State Energy Office. It was the recipient of three of the listed awards, and two of them, totaling about $18 million, are going towards technology to keep Kauai's electric grid stable as it brings online more intermittent energy resources like solar. And the Kauai Island Utility Cooperative was a subcontractor on these grants. They were the ones who really stood to benefit from this federal funding. I spoke with Chief Energy Officer Mark Glick, who called the termination of these projects highly disappointing.
This was for grid-forming technology, basically arrays of batteries and grid-forming inverters and something else called synchronous condensers. These systems would allow it to operate at 70%, 80% renewable in a very solid state. And extremely important for it to get to that next stage of renewable integration. And in fact, these projects were in advanced stages of deployment. So we will be appealing this pretty vigorously. We don't really understand why you would cancel a project that is in the middle of deployment.
Yeah, what a setback.
Yeah, and as you heard, they are progressing with the appeal process. In their announcement, the U.S. Department of Energy said that award recipients would have 30 days to appeal. But something that's a little tricky about that is when I started reaching out to recipients last week, many of them had yet to receive any termination notice or actual correspondence from the Department of Energy about their awards. One recipient told me that they had actually found out from the news that their funding was not being renewed. So they don't have a lot of clarity on how to move forward, either to keep their funding intact or to go through this appeals process. The Hawaii State Energy Office was in that boat in regards to the Kauai projects, but they did receive a notice terminating about $1 million in funding for another project. And that was meant to spur the adoption of zero-emission vehicles throughout the state's fleet and also expand charging infrastructure to support electric cars. And Glitz said in that case, the Energy Office immediately put a stop work order for the project. And they were informed in the notice, the language of it, was that the project was no longer consistent with the U.S. Department of Energy's priorities. And, you know, the Trump administration has consistently targeted federal programs and regulations that support electric vehicles. But Glitz said this was still surprising to get this termination notice for this project because the Department of Energy had approved this grant funding only 4 weeks ago. So it was a really fast about face on the federal side with regards to this project.
That's crazy. Just a month's notice. Yes, and now it's no. What can you tell us about the other Hawaii projects?
So other Hawaii recipients include Ameresco. They received a huge chunk of money, $40 million, to develop a microgrid at Joint Base Pearl Harbor Hickam. That's to keep power to that base if the power goes off more broadly on the grid. The University of Hawaii was doing some research into hydrogen vehicles, and they were on that list of cut awards. And then Oceanet Laboratories, which is also doing some work with hydrogen. And outside of Hawaii, you see hydrogen as one of the large targets. One of the big awards that was canceled was for the Northwest Hydrogen Hub. That's a hub in the Northwest that was supposed to explore the uses of hydrogen to further power electricity and other functions. And many of the projects on the list, including those under the State Energy Office, were awarded either as part of the Biden-era Infrastructure and Investments and Jobs Act or the Inflation Reduction Act. And Glick says that those acts have been consistent targets of the Trump administration.
We heard previously in discussions with our delegation, congressional delegation, that the GRIP awards, as well as the electric vehicle awards, were on target lists. So apparently the administration had been eyeing projects like this to kind of roll back or to eliminate the funding in some manner.
Yeah, it's a shame because, you know, a lot of these projects were really meant to help with our resiliency.
Yeah. And the other consistent thing is, at least from this first list, of the 223 projects the DOE identified, almost all of them are in Democratic states. And when the Director of Office of Management and Budget, Russell Vogt, posted about the cancellations on X, he called it green new dam funding that is fueling the left's climate agenda. So Democrats are really seeing this as a move to try to apply political pressure as Republicans and Democrats remain really divided on the government shutdown. There is a new list that is circling on Capitol Hill now that includes additional grants in red states, and that would total up to $20 billion in funding. So we could see more cuts coming down the line, but we just have yet to see the same impact in red states as we're seeing in blue states.
Yeah, but again, you know, a lot of these projects were about resiliency, and, you know, even the ones on the military bases, so critical to, you know, the Navy's efforts to be ready. But we'll see what happens.
Certainly. We'll keep tracking this.
Okay, thanks so much, Savannah. That was HPR's Savannah Harriman-Pote, who is tracking the latest proposed cuts to federal energy projects out here in the islands. On the tech scene, a new artificial intelligence model is making waves for its ability to create realistic video. OpenAI, the company that makes ChatGPT, released something called Sora 2 last week, and it came with a social media app populated entirely by AI-generated videos. NPR's All Things Considered called the early results of the new model wowing and worrying. The conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with Iolani School's emerging technologies teacher, Gabriel Yanagihara. They discussed what you need to know about the new video generation model and its potential for realistic deepfakes.
In the same way we saw ChatGPT take the world by storm, where it can have a computer that can type and send, you know, create text for you, ChatGPT's parent company OpenAI launched Sora 2, the second generation of their video model. So it's text to video. You can type in anything you want, feed it any sort of raw information, and it'll be able to create video for you. And this is unique in that it's creating video that never existed before. Right, it's completely synthetic. You know, if you've ever seen a video on Instagram of a bunny hopping on a trampoline and then throws a shaka or something like that, or if you've seen a monk seal doing backflips on a trampoline, or someone surfing on a dolphin, it's opened this whole world where any video you want to make, you can ask, and it'll just make it for you. There have been technologies around for the last couple of years that can generate high-quality video, completely artificial AI videos, fake videos, but they required some technical skill to pull it off and do installations and pay for premium services and stuff like that. But they've launched Sora 2, their video generator, for free for anyone. And what's crazy about that is now anyone can create video of anything they want, both for positive or negative, and whatever outcomes that means for society.
And you've had the chance to play around with it a bit. What sorts of ways have you prompted the model, and how have you found it to be different than other AI video generators?
Yeah, so part of my role of being an emerging technologies teacher is to be the guinea pig to test things out. So Sora 2 has a feature where you can upload a couple seconds of someone's face and voice in a video, and then the AI will be able to generate them again, what's called a deepfake, a fake version of them doing something on the video, whatever you tell the app to do, and it would make them do it. So as a test, I tried to stretch to see how far I could take this. So I did one where I did a video of myself surfing on a dolphin in Waikiki, and it generated a pretty good rendition of myself. Then I tried to go back to some of my viral videos in the past, like the humpback whale on the Alawai Canal and some of those, and I tried to regenerate them but have me in it as well. So I was able to make a video of myself standing on a humpback whale in the Alawai Canal, saying that I'm doing this, like a vlog, like I'm talking about it, like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm on a whale in Waikiki. And the voice sounds like me and the video sounds like me. You can only really tell it's fake because it's absurd that someone would do this. But if you tone it down a little bit, like you can create, I could have myself do anything, right?
I think that kind of gets at the potential for something like this model or ones in the future to be able to produce really realistic, essentially deepfakes. So just what are the ways that this tool could be used, and is there potential for misuse here, in your opinion?
In some of the examples and stuff that I've explored, with the deepfakes, the problem comes in when if someone else gets access to your likeness, right? Whether it's an organization or an institution, and you don't have proper training or proper AI literacy established within your organization, there could be a situation where an outside entity was able to get footage of your CEO or your HR manager and then upload it to a service like this, not necessarily SOAR 2 directly, but any of these AI video generating tools, and could send out a video or even a voice call or something to your entire staff saying like, hey, congratulations, you've been promoted. Please click this link and you'll get a 30% raise. And then that link is a phishing attack and so on and so forth. So it's just a more sophisticated play on some of the cybersecurity issues and social engineering issues that we've seen for the last couple of decades, just taking to the next level because now it's actual a video call from your boss saying these things. So a lot of the work that we're going to have to do addressing these new technologies and what they can do is just literacy is the big one, right? You know, being able to look at content and do all the critical thinking and fact checking to verify if this is in fact something that's happened through vetted sources or through good research on your own is going to be like a life skill that everyone's going to need to have. Or we're going to enter this era where we're kind of past knowing if anything's ever real ever again. What's crazy about the SOAR 2 app, though, like social media itself is built around content creators and all of us doing cool and crazy things, filming it and putting it in front of an audience to give them a shared experience, to give them a dopamine hit and all that stuff. Like you see a fun video of a cat dancing, you feel good in your brain and you keep scrolling on Instagram. What SOAR 2 did is they made their own clone of Instagram, an entire app. But on that app, nothing is real. And what's the craziest feeling is scrolling on that app, knowing that it's all AI and none of this matters and none of this is real, and getting that same dopamine hit and feeling in your brain, whether it was a real cat or an AI cat. I think we're at the very early stages of not knowing what that's going to mean for society, for, you know, any sort of addiction to these devices, addiction to AI video. There's a whole generation of capabilities now in an app that in which nothing's real, which is such a weird thing to say out loud.
Are there any quote-unquote tells of videos made using SOAR 2.0? I think, honestly, we're probably past the point when people used to say, oh, look at the hands, look at the ears. That's how you can tell it's AI generated. I think the models have gotten so sophisticated that that might not be the case anymore. But is there anything more subtle that viewers can look for to tell them whether a video might be AI generated or not, or that you've seen experimenting with this model?
To be completely honest, we're getting to the phase where I can't even tell if some of these videos are real or not. And this is essentially my job, is to be able to differentiate these things and explore these things and see what the limitations are. The scary thing is that SOAR 2 isn't even the best video model for realism out there. Because they're posting it free, they're marketing it a little bit. They put a watermark on each video that says SOAR AI generated, like just showing the brand name on it for everything. But eventually that will go away, and eventually it'll be a situation where even now, I scroll on my Instagram feed and there's no way of me telling if something's AI generated or not. There are companies who are doing the work required where when you upload something, you have to tick if it was AI generated or not. But for every person who follows the rules, there's going to be a person who doesn't follow the rules. And on top of all of this, like when you get to the state actor level or the entrepreneurial like self-starter, there are open source AI tools. Tools that you can run on your home computer that can generate any video you want. And there's no watermark, there's no check mark, there's no checks and balances for any of that stuff. And because that cat's already out of the bag and anyone can do it, there's not any real way of detecting it. So in general, the one rule I say for people is if it's some sort of video that gets an emotional reaction out of you, just fact check it. Take a second, breathe, pause, especially if it's a video of a family member or someone you know that's sending you a video. Honestly, go back to a code word within your family, within your network, within your school organization. Ask that extra question that would pull out the reality from whether it actually happened or not. That's why, like with the AI literacy thing, I really try to teach people just do the critical thinking, like watch the video, enjoy it if it's a cat video, knowing that it could be real or not. But if it comes to something that has impact in your life, have a higher level of scrutiny on how much fact-checking you do with it, right? Because one of the things I'm really worried about in our workforce and everything is people see the bad AI videos and they're like, oh, I know what AI videos look like. So when they see a good AI video, one made with one of the higher level tools or with more lighting or better layout and everything, then they automatically trust it because they have this false sense of, well, you know, for the last 3 years, I could tell if it was AI or not. But now, as of this week, I can't anymore. But I built that false sense of security around whether something I visually see can be determined if it's AI or not.
We need to retrain our own models, basically.
Yeah, we need to retrain how we think and look at media in general. It's going to be really wild, to the point where you could have it generate footage of Honolulu Police Department, doing backflips and yoga or whatever. There's literally no limitations on what these video models can do. So there's a lot of work that we're going to have to do with either public trust or public education to let people know, if you see a video of the mayor or the governor or someone you know doing something crazy, to fact check it a little bit, right? To know that these capabilities are there. One of the biggest strengths of AI literacy is once you understand how the technology works, even at a very basic level, it kind of inoculates you a little bit. It kind of protects you a little bit from the visceral reaction, because now you have this layer of kind of suspicion on top of everything you see that kind of communicates, at least into yourself. It's like a safety mechanism in your head that says, wow, that was crazy, but there's AI now. Could it have been AI? At that single moment of catching yourself, I think is going to be a very valuable skill for people going forward.
Yep. Is that for real? That was emerging technologies educator Gabriel Yanagihara and HPR's Maddie Bender. They were talking about AI video generation. OpenAI's newest model was just released last week. Yanagihara says the best protection against being tricked by a video deepfake is keeping up to date on the latest AI models and their capabilities. He shared that some of the early results of AI-generated videos he's made with Sora, and we'll have links to that on our website after the show. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. We've got a chittering chorus of shorebirds thanks to the Macaulay Library at Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology. University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart introduces us to the sanderling.
Hunakai, also known as sanderlings, are common winter visitors to the Hawaiian Islands. At just about 8 inches long from their tail to the tip of their bill, they're among the smallest of our many visiting shorebirds. Like other shorebirds, they molt into different plumage colors twice a year. In their winter or non-breeding plumage, which is the one we typically see, they have mostly bright white heads and bellies, jet black bills, and grayish plumage on their backs. Then, during the breeding season, the plumage of both sexes changes to a more reddish brown on their heads and backs. In Hawaii, Hunakai can often be found on sandy shores, running back and forth between receding waves, searching for crabs and worms that live in the wet sand between the tides. They can sometimes also be found in rocky tide pool areas and around mudflats in mixed flocks with other shorebird species. You can listen for a twittering series of soft, squeaky wick-wick calls. The Hawaiian name for sanderlings, or hunakai, means seafoam, which is appropriate as they spend a lot of time searching for food near the breaking waves on the shoreline. The white-flowered morning glory you can find along some beaches at the high tide mark also has the name hunakai. Hunakai nest and breed in the high Arctic tundra during summer, where they construct nests on the ground and lay camouflage-colored eggs to help protect them from predators. Similar to many shorebirds, the chicks are precocial, and so don't depend on parents much after hatching. Hunakai can be seen during the winter months in almost all temperate and tropical beaches around the world. Our birds arrive by late July or early August, after making the long non-stop flight across the Pacific that can take them 3 days or more. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Hawaii Forest and Trail. Learn more about the Mauna Kea Summit and STARS Giveback experience, including a volunteering opportunity, at hawaii-forest.com.
Thank you.
new book to be published later this year is all about ulu. Breadfruit, Three Global Journeys of a Bountiful Tree, traces the history of the plant as it's spread across the globe throughout colonialism, and it looks at various uses in different regions. Russell Fielding is an associate professor at Coastal Carolina University and the author of the new history. He spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about why he decided to write the book in the first place.
For many years, I've been working doing research in several islands in the Southern Caribbean, most especially Barbados and St. Vincent. And I was not studying breadfruit. It wasn't my research subject, but I was eating it all the time. And I was resting in the shade of the trees, and I was watching other people harvest it and prepare it. And I got interested to learn more about this tree that didn't look like any other trees in the area, and the fruit that certainly didn't look like any other fruits in the region. So I started researching breadfruit as just kind of a side project for a while, but it grew and grew, and I went looking for a book about breadfruit. I wanted to check out a book from the library or buy one, and I found that none existed. There were books that mentioned breadfruit, and that there were books from a very long time ago that maybe served to guide people who wanted to grow breadfruit, and they came with a lot of technical horticultural advice, but I couldn't find a book that told the story of breadfruit. And I remembered back to a piece of advice that Toni Morrison gave, and it was in an interview that was conducted with her, that if you go looking for a book and can't find it, that means that you need to be the one to write that book. So I decided to embark upon a book project, and breadfruit or ulu would be the subject.
And in many ways, your research kind of took you on the same journey that the crop did. So talk a little bit about the places you visited and the ways that you kind of tried to immerse yourself into this global story.
That's true. That's a good observation. I took the same journey, or one of the same journeys as breadfruit, but I did it in reverse. So I started in the Caribbean and learned about ulu's Pacific origins, and traveled back to the Pacific to seek out some of its more distant history. And also, because it doesn't only live in the past, to seek out evidence of its in contemporary Pacific societies. So I traveled to the Pacific after having already begun the breadfruit research in the Caribbean. And going there, I knew that Hawaii would be an obvious place to spend a lot of time. And I'm sure cumulatively, I did spend more time in Hawaii than any other group of Pacific islands, but I didn't restrict myself to working in Hawaii. I visited Micronesia and the Marianas and Guam and Samoa, and also American Samoa, and several islands through French Polynesia, including Tahiti and Moorea, little island of Mopiti, and one of my favorite, the Marquesas. So this research project really took me all across the territory that ulu or breadfruit had visited and settled long before I came on the scene. And so in visiting these different places, I was able both to get a sense for the history and the journeys that this tree would have taken in the past, but also learn from the people who are using it today. In every one of those islands, breadfruit's being cultivated and consumed and appreciated by people today. And I was very fortunate to get to learn from a lot of those people.
Here in Hawaii, we know of ulu as this canoe crop, right, brought here by the Polynesian voyagers. But it's so interesting to me to think of how the practice of growing and cultivating and cooking and even just mythologizing might have changed between these different islands. So if you could just briefly compare, contrast, what are some of the interesting ways that ulu and the production of it grew for the thousands of years that it was spread across Polynesia?
So it changed a lot. And the reason for the change, or for most of the changes, it comes down to the way that it's cultivated. Ulu is almost never planted by seed. Most of the varieties that grow now, except in the Western Pacific, don't even produce seeds regularly. Most listeners will know that ulu growing in Hawaii very rarely, if ever, produces seeds. And when you cultivate it, you take a cutting. And so what you're doing is creating a clone. So you're cloning a tree that has the features and the characteristics that you want to copy. And that clone, or that cutting, can be planted in the same field as the tree from which it was taken, or it can be wrapped carefully and put onto a canoe and sailed all the way across the Pacific Ocean. That's how Ulu was dispersed all those thousands of years ago by the original Pacific voyagers. So we can think of a map of the Pacific Ocean spreading from west to east, which is the direction that by and large it was settled. And we can see that as a timeline of Ulu development, where the traits that were desirable would arise and be carried further east. So what you get as you go further and further east across the Pacific is a refinement of what people want Ulu to be. So the large fruits, the tasty fruits, the seasonality, the seedlessness, these are all characteristics that people would have selected for as they were planting the crop on different islands proceeding further and further eastward.
Wow. So it's a scientific story, too, of artificial selection. Is there any way that that influences the types of contemporary Ulu preparation across the Pacific? Like, if you have a smaller fruit, are you more likely to prepare it a distinct way?
Yes, different varieties have different recipes that they're better suited for. And even fruits from the same tree, when picked at different times in their process of becoming ripe, will be used in different ways. One of my favorite stories of the ways that different varieties of Ulu are used differently comes from that little island in western French Polynesia, Mopiti. Mopiti is a tiny island. I think its ring road that encircles the island is only about 8 kilometers long, but it has such an incredible density of Ulu varieties. Dozens of varieties grow on Mopiti, and they have a tradition there where each variety of Ulu is paired with a different species of fish. So when a certain variety of Ulu is in season, you're fishing for that species of fish because you're going to eat them together as the same meal. And the byproduct of this is that when that variety of Ulu goes out of season, you stop fishing for that fish, which ends up being a form of conservation, even though no one really considers it that way.
We've been hearing from Russell Fielding, the author of the book Breadfruit, Three Global Journeys of a Bountiful Tree. We'll hear more about the journey of Ulu beyond the Pacific right after a break.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA, celebrating over 87 years of dedication in supporting the health and well-being of the people of Hawaii with a commitment to caring for the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
What if you could make bets on the government shutdown, the World Series, and sales of Taylor Swift's new album all on the same website? Well, on platforms like Polymarket and Kalshi, you can.
If you're aggregating the wisdom of the crowd, and you're having people with real skin in the game being paid to forecast the future.
The explosive growth of prediction markets and how life changes when everything's a gamble. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, and the Rice Partnership.
Let's get back to our conversation with author Russell Fielding about his soon-to-be-released book, Breadfruit, Three Global Journeys of a Bountiful Tree. He picks up the story of how breadfruit reached the Caribbean through a connection to the infamous mutiny on the Bounty.
So the story of Ulu reaching the Caribbean starts off in kind of a dark period. When European countries had set up colonies throughout the Caribbean, mostly to produce sugar, but a few other cash crops as well. And of course, these plantations were served by slave labor. the British and the French and some of the other countries or some of the other people who were managing these plantations knew that the less they had to spend on maintaining their enslaved workforce, the more profit they could make. So they went looking for food crops that would basically grow themselves without a lot of human intervention. If a tree can produce food, and if that food had been compared to bread, and no human effort is needed, or very little human effort is needed to grow that food, then that's an economic win for the plantation. So the British dispatched a ship called the Bounty to travel to Tahiti to take cuttings of ulu from Tahiti and to bring them to the Caribbean for planting. And with the mention of the ship's name, most listeners are going to know what happened. This is the ship that had the infamous mutiny. The captain was disposed, sent off on a lifeboat, miraculously made it back to England, but the crew took control of the Bounty, returned to Tahiti to pick up the women that they had met while they were there harvesting ulu, and sailed off to settle Pitcairn Island, where their descendants still live today. The captain made it back to England, was exonerated for losing the ship, was given another ship, given a second chance, and sent back to Tahiti to finish the job. And this time he was successful. Breadfruit was introduced in the Caribbean, first the island of St. Vincent, and then Jamaica in 1793. And it was spread throughout the region after that as a cheap or even free food for enslaved laborers. And so you might imagine that the people who were intended to be fed by this food started off with a pretty poor image of it. Breadfruit was not popular at all. It wasn't even considered fit for human consumption in the Caribbean for the entire time that slavery persisted. But after emancipation, the Caribbean people who were now free started to reconsider breadfruit. And today in the Caribbean, there's still some suspicion. There's still some stigma of slavery in some places and among some people. But by and large, it's been redeemed, and it's a beloved part of the food landscape in most Caribbean islands, to the level that many people don't consider it to be an imported food at all. They think of it as a native food that they've always had. I compare the degree to which breadfruit is loved in places like Barbados and St. Vincent and Jamaica with the degree to which ulu is loved and has been loved in Hawaii and Tahiti.
What's one preparation that's typical in the Caribbean?
My favorite way of preparing breadfruit comes from Barbados, and it's to take an entire breadfruit, don't peel the skin off, just take it as it is, wash it, and place it on an open fire, and turn it from time to time so that it gets cooked evenly. You want the skin to turn nice and black, and then the breadfruit is cut in half, and the core is scraped out. And some of the fruit's flesh is scraped out as well and diced and sauteed with whatever ingredients you want to add to it. I usually like mine with some peppers and onions, some black beans are a nice addition. Douse the whole thing in garlic butter and then place it back into the scraped out breadfruit, almost like a bread bowl that you have with soup sometimes. And then with a spoon, you eat the filling. And if that's not enough, you scrape whatever remaining fruit is there until you get to the black outside. And by then, you're usually going to be fully satisfied.
Do you think there's something inherent about how breadfruit tastes that it can lend itself so easily to incorporation across cultures? It's a little mean to call its flavor bland, but there is something like starchy. It soaks up sauces well. You can grill it, or because of that tough exterior, like you were saying, you can put it over an open fire. But what do you think?
The best description I've heard of breadfruit by a chef is to call it a blank canvas. It's a starch. It does have a bit of a bland taste when you eat it by itself without any seasoning, but it can absorb and accept almost anything that you place onto it. I've had breadfruit in Puerto Rico where it formed the crust of a pizza. Not breadfruit flour, which is its own product, but actual mashed breadfruit that had been grilled on top of a griddle and then topped like a pizza. I've had it in West Africa where it stood in for fufu, which is a traditional starchy substance that they eat there. It really is like the understudy for nearly any other starchy crop. And that's only in places where it's been introduced later in history. All through the Pacific, it's not an understudy. It's the primary food product to a lot of cultures. So having it in places like the Marquesas, where there's a traditional way of fermenting breadfruit to give it a real tart, citrusy taste, nobody would eat Marquesan fermented breadfruit and come away thinking of blandness. It's a delicious, citrusy, sugary flavor that you only get after letting it ferment in the dark for 3 months at a time.
Is there anything else that you want to add or anything that you think listeners here in Hawaii should know about your book, which comes out in November, if I'm not mistaken?
So the book comes out on November 11th. I'm planning to give some talks throughout Hawaii. I've got a few scheduled on Oahu and Hawaii Island for now, and I'm hoping to expand that. For me, this whole adventure of following breadfruit around the world for several years has been such a learning experience. I've learned about botany and horticulture, which are not fields that I studied previously. I'm trained as a geographer. I've learned about history in new ways and in new areas that I had not gotten into before. I think, though, that the most important lessons I've learned are neither culinary, botanary, nor even historical or even really academic. I learned lessons from breadfruit that I've tried hard to apply to my own life. In Hawaii, for example, listening to the stories of breadfruit's origin, of Ku, the god who descended into the ground during a time of famine and came back as the first ulu tree that anyone had ever seen, that teaches me the lesson of self-sacrifice. It teaches me the lesson of giving abundantly. And as the recipients of that tree showed, it teaches the lesson of gratitude, of being grateful for the gifts that we're given. In the Caribbean, where breadfruit was rejected for so long, and even while it was rejected, it continued to produce food. I see the lessons, or I've learned the lessons of redemption, of making up for past wrongs. I mean, breadfruit was considered to be a co-conspirator with the enslavers. You know, it was an accessory to the crime of slavery. And yet, it redeemed itself, and the Caribbean people, mostly, by and large, have forgiven it. And so I learned lessons there about making up for past wrongs and forgiving those who have legitimately come to one of us with a request for forgiveness and with a true apology. I see breadfruit as exemplifying some of the best aspects that humans aspire to have. And I think that if we all spent more time paying attention to elements of the natural environment that we don't normally think of as having human qualities, that there's a lot that we could all learn from what we see in nature.
That was author and professor Russell Fielding talking about his book, Breadfruit, Three Global Journeys of a Bountiful Tree. The book will be published by Columbia University Press this December, and we'll have an exclusive excerpt from the book on our website. Head to hawaiipublicradio.org later today. Well, we have to go now, but we do want to know your thoughts about Skyline. Are you looking forward to the new leg on the train? Do you use it now, or where do you plan to take it? Leave your feedback on our TalkBack line, 808-792-8217, or email TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find our archive shows online by searching for The Conversation on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.